It's peak toy shopping time, and parents are hitting the stores shopping for the perfect toy for the little ones in their life. And along the way, they'll likely find themselves strolling down a lot of very pink and very blue toy aisles.
Definitely. And our next guest says whether we realize it or not, when a toy is marketed to a specific gender, it changes the way that the kids respond to that toy. She joins us now to talk about some of the science behind gender-labeled toys.
Christia Brown is with us now. She's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Kentucky and the author of Parenting Beyond Pink and Blue. Christia, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, first off, are we seeing more toys with gender-specific marketing this last year or two, or fewer toys marketed like that?
I think that we've seen a real, I mean, I would say over the past couple of years, we've seen a real divergence. So in many ways, we're seeing more and more toys that are marketed very specifically for girls or very specifically for boys. But then you also see this other kind of trend where you're trying to have more toys that bridge the gap. So the toys that are traditionally boy kind of subjects, things like Goldilocks, but they're marketed for girls. So you see kind of both trends going on at the same time.
And recently, you know, Target made headlines, this was a couple years ago, that they were going to get rid of the labels saying
right.
toys for boys and toys for girls. What do you think about that move?
I think it's fantastic. I think it's what we have been talking about in research for the past 20 years, that the label is really important for kids. The label is actually more important than the toy itself. So there's been several studies at this point, dozens, which have shown kids different sets of toys. When you just show them the toy, you see that both boys and girls are interested in it. But if you label it as a boy toy, the girls don't want to play with it. And if you label it as a girl toy, the boys all of a sudden don't want to play with it. So often it's not the toy itself, but it's the label. And kids pay attention to those kind of clues. They look at what aisle it's on. They look at what kind of packaging it has. You know, they look at things as subtle as, are there boys or girls on the box playing with the toy? And studies have shown that that drives kids' interest more than the toy itself.
Yeah, there's a lot of studies, and I read about one where there was a clown toy with an open mouth, and the kids had to toss some sort of rings or something into the mouth, and how they thought about it depended on what researchers told them. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So it was a study done a couple of decades ago now, but it's been replicated again in kind of similar methods. But what they found is it was a toy where you toss little kind of small rings into this clown's mouth, and they told half of the kids it's like I think it's like baseball, if memory serves. It's either baseball or basketball, but it's a very kind of male typical toy game. And the other half of the kids, they said this is a game kind of like Jack's, which is a toy that girls were traditionally playing with. And what they found was when they described it as like a ball game, like baseball or basketball, then the boys were literally better at it. They got more of the discs into the clown's mouth. If it was described as Jack's, the girls literally performed better. They got more of the discs into the clown's mouth than if they heard the opposite. So it's not only affects like what they like and what they say they're interested in, it also affects how well they play with it.
That's so interesting. So it's not just luck of the draw that the girls happen to do better one time and the boys happen to do better the next time. This has been replicated.
It has been replicated, and there's been several studies like this. They've done other kinds of toys where they'll have the researchers kind of make up a toy. They do something that we know no boy or girl has ever seen before, and they'll give the boys this toy, and they'll say, this is something that girls have been shown to enjoy. And then the other half of the kids will say, this is something that boys have been shown to enjoy. And the kids will spend longer looking at it. They'll just investigate the toy longer. They'll figure out how the knobs turn and the buttons push better when it's described as something that fits their gender than if it's the exact same toy but described as something that fits the other gender.
So this is interesting because, you know, there was a pushback. If you look at the Target labeling
right.
thing we just talked about, there were some parents who said, you know, this is helpful to parents. I have a girl or I have a boy, and this is meaningless. It just helps me to shop. It's not going to affect the kid and the toy, but this research seems to say not so fast.
Well, and what we know is that kids have a lot of individual variability. So kids aren't stereotypes. So an individual girl might like dolls, but she might also like trucks and also like games that involve boys and also like science-focused play. Just like boys might also like arts and crafts, and they might also like more kind of nurturing types of toys. And so the problem with labeling it is you remove any of that individual variation. You basically say any of those traits that you might have that don't fit neatly in the stereotype are not acceptable. When really we know all kids should have nurturing, fostered. All kids should be able to play in caretaking types of toys, because we want both boys and girls to learn how to take care of others and how to be nurturing and empathetic. And those are really great skills you learn with dolls. But if boys think this is only for girls, they're not going to be playing with those toys that can be really beneficial for when they become dads later on. And the same is for girls. There's lots of toys that boys play with that are really good for girls, things like Legos, things like ball play, which help hand-eye coordination. But if we put it in a boy aisle, the girls are not going to want to play with it, even though those are going to be really good skills for them to develop.
We're talking right now with University of Kentucky professor Christia Brown about how kids respond to gender-specific toys, and we want to hear from you on this.
If you're a parent or if you're shopping for kids, do you care if a toy is labeled for boys or for girls? Do you try to steer your kids toward gender-neutral toys? Do you think it made a difference in how you saw the world looking back at the toys you grew up with? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Vera.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up on our conversation right now about what science has to say about gender-labeled toys as parents hit the stores with their holiday shopping. Christia Brown stays with us. She's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Kentucky, and she's the author of Parenting Beyond Pink and Blue.
We'd love to get your take on this. Do you care if a toy is labeled for boys or for girls? Do you think stores like Target should have gender-neutral aisles, or should they have a boy aisle here, a girl aisle there? Does that make a difference for a kid whether they're playing with boys or girls toys or gender neutral toys? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Judy on the line in Franklin. Judy, hi.
Good evening. I just have a comment. I was with my 3-year-old granddaughter in Barnes & Noble. They don't usually have toys, but she expressed interest in walking over there, of course. She entered the aisle and told me, this aisle, this side is for girls, and this side is for boys, and paid no attention to anything in the boys' aisle.
And this is a 3-year-old.
A 3-year-old. I did talk to the manager and let that person know that that was not acceptable to me. In the same amount of room, they could easily have mixed up those toys and had a much more interesting array for children.
Judy, thank you so much for that. You took action. You talked to the manager. That's an interesting solution, Judy, proposing there. So if you look at that Target example from a while back, they just got rid of some of the labels. But Judy's proposing mix it all up so you can't tell. What do you think about an idea like that?
I think that's fantastic. And I think she's captured exactly what kids do. She was lucky that her granddaughter actually expressed it, because I think that's exactly what they do. They look at it and they completely dismiss it. And the reality is, if kids like a certain toy, they'll gravitate towards the toy they like. Why does the company need to go ahead and restrict it ahead of time? Let's let kids' own natural interest pick what they like. But we know when they separate the toys out, the kids don't even look at the aisle that doesn't kind of fit them. So I think that's a perfect solution. Have them just mixed up so that you just have toys. And then kids gravitate towards the things that naturally look interesting to them.
I want to ask you about something that caught my eye recently. It was a research about the Dr. Barbie, and also that it's sort of more empowering. They're supposed to be empowering anyway. Barbie versions of veterinarians and soccer coaches and doctors. And these are Barbies who are dressed like these various professions, and they're supposed to empower girls, but it didn't quite work out that way. What happened, Christia?
What they find is that girls, even when they play with the Dr. Barbie, they then ask, and they compare it with girls that are playing with other toys. For example, the Mrs. Potato Head was their kind of comparable toy. And what they find is afterwards they ask them, there's different studies, and some of them ask them, what kinds of careers would you want to do? And they have a whole list, and kids pick the ones that seem interesting to do. They say, pick all the ones that you think might be interesting. And what they find was that the girls that play with the Mrs. Potato Head pick many more potential careers than the girls that play with the Dr. Barbie. And the ones that play with the Dr. Barbie pick much more feminine gender-type careers, things like secretaries, for example, and teachers and nurses.
So what is going on there?
Well, the reality is Dr. Barbie doesn't really look like a doctor. Dr. Barbie is still highly sexualized. She really has a sexualized figure. She doesn't dress like the doctors that kids would see when they go to the pediatrician. And we know from also a lot of research that kids, when they play with sexualized toys, which is a lot of them, but Barbie, the Monster High dolls, Bratz dolls, that kind of category of toys, girls, for one, they feel worse about their bodies. They feel that they're too big for their than what they want to be. They're more likely to say they want to be on a diet, and that's even girls as young as 7 and 8. We know that they're more likely to objectify their bodies, so they're more worried about what other people think about their bodies. And we also know that girls think that these sexualized images are incompatible with being smart. So that's where it really becomes dangerous, is because they think that if I'm going to be sexualized means I'm going to be pretty and popular, but to be pretty and popular means I can't be smart. And so you see girls in elementary school kind of picking one or the other, the pretty, popular, which means sexualized for them in their kind of world, or smart and academically minded. And so I think that's where there's a disconnect with the Dr. Barbie, for example, is because, yes, she's supposed to be high-achieving as a doctor, but the sexualized message for kids is much more salient, and that pushes them away from higher aspirations.
Let's back get back to our calls here. We'll take one more here from Sarah in Milwaukee. Sarah, hi.
Hi. I have a comment. I am the mother of 4 children. I've got 3 boys and a girl. And, we just have toys. We don't have girls' toys. We don't have boys' toys. We just have toys. And I think because we've not labeled them and because we've not said, oh, you're a boy, you can't play with this, or you're a girl, so you don't get to play with that, our children, I think, just naturally will play with whatever's available. So much so that my 4-year-old son, for his birthday, the one thing that he really, really wanted was an Anna dress and an Elsa dress to play dress-up in. And if you got a list of just one thing on it, you're going to get that thing for that kid. And, we did have some pushback from other relatives who were maybe not so supportive. But overall, we thought, listen, this is what this child wants. We're not going to bully him and tell him that this is not something that he can do because he happens to be a boy.
Sarah, thank you so much. You get the last word. And Christia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Christia Brown is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Kentucky, and she's the author of Parenting Beyond Pink and Blue. She joins us to talk about what science has to say about gender-labeled toys, and you can find an article listing some more of the research and the science behind gender-labeled toys on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Riggert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. There's a new volunteer group helping recovering brain injury and stroke victims at the UW Hospital Neuroscience Intensive Care Unit. And the volunteers have a keen sense of what patients might be going through.
That's because they've made the long journey back from their own brain injuries. They've signed on with the new Brain Injury Peer Visitor Program, the first of its kind in the Midwest. Joining us now to discuss the program is Jody Atwile. She's a case manager for UW Hospital Neurosciences Intensive Care Unit. Jody, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
And Jody, I understand you had something like this kind of on an informal basis, but you've made a more established program based on something already going on in the Southeast. Can you tell us a little bit about that program?
Absolutely. We had a patient come forward who was interested in volunteering, and we did it in an informal type of way. And then we had another patient come forward that had found this Brain Injury Peer Visitor Association in Atlanta, Georgia, found it via the internet, and asked if we couldn't bring that program up here to Wisconsin and to UW. And so I said, well, absolutely. When we have a patient identifying something in the community that we don't have, that is well needed in the community, likewise. So we move forward based on that communication.
And when we're talking about the patients themselves and the volunteers, what kind of experience have we been through? What kind of things are causing these brain injuries?
Yeah, absolutely. So these are former patients. Some are from UW and some are from outside of the area including other states. And they've had anywhere from traumatic injuries, from falls, motor vehicle accidents, et cetera, to brain tumors, strokes, transient ischemic attacks, various things, any type of brain injury.
Well, let's talk about that recovery. I mean, people, I imagine, know that there's a lot of medical issues going on, but we've experienced this in my family. It's also a very mentally and emotionally challenging situation, very fatiguing. What kind of things do people need this kind of peer support to get through?
Right. So our basis is starting here in the hospital with the hopes of connecting with the patients in the acute phase, both in the ICU and the general care floor, to make that initial contact. And what they're doing is these peers are coming in, meeting with these families and the patient, if they're able to communicate, providing the immediate support in the sense of really identifying with them either the deficits that the patients are having or the struggles that the family's having when the patient, you know, can't communicate, and being the caregivers in the acute care environment. And they provide them with a packet of information, really with contacts, whether it be by phone, email, or internet of any kind. And they provide them with a packet of resources that have different volunteer groups in the community, therapies, ride transportation support groups, and so on. And so they really look to the acute phase, but some of these things they're not going to identify with sometimes 6 months, a year out from their injury, even longer. And so the hopes is that they have this resource so when they experience it, they can connect back with this program on an outpatient basis.
Talking to Jody Atwell, case manager for UW Hospital Neurosciences, talking about a new, this is the first of its kind in the Midwest. It's a brain injury peer visitor program at UW Hospital where people who have suffered some kind of traumatic brain injury are paired up with a volunteer who's been through it, been through the recovery process before. And Jody, how much does it help for someone in that initial acute situation, maybe in the early stages of rehabilitation, to be able to connect with someone who's been through it before? What do they get out of that?
Well, the feedback has really been phenomenal. They can relate with the patients where we can't. And I've had feedback that it was just so helpful to have someone come in, sit down in the room with them, and spend 10, 15, 20 minutes just kind of going over what they experience and kind of identifying some of the same similarities. And it's really that the patients find someone they can relate to while they're here in the hospital.
And in those early stages in rehabilitation, I know frustration is really a common thing because maybe some kind of common action like a motor skill or something that we take for granted is impossible or it's labor to do. Is it helpful to have somebody who made it through that stage and can say, yeah, it's worth the work, it does get better, or you get more used to it as you work at it?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, some of the visitors, when they come in and meet with the patients, they'll just start talking, and then, you know, they'll have their own issues, whether it be the scattered thoughts or the loss in of their memory, or the forgetfulness is a big thing. And we kind of joke when they come in to visit, you know, I even have lapses in my memory, and I'll say, so it doesn't always take a brain injury to have that. It's just a joke we have between each other. But no, the patients, when they, like the weakness, the balance deficits, the ongoing headaches, the forgetfulness, the tiredness, and I think that's probably overlooked of how tired these people are. And they, in the packets, they have this letter from your brain, and it's really a reflection of what your brain, the trauma that it's experienced, and how you need to be patient with it, because the road to recovery is a long road and needs resources to help it.
And you mentioned family members maybe having access to some of these volunteers too, I think. What can they get out of the experience of talking to people who are further along on this road than their own loved one is?
Visitors, we have 6 survivors and 1 caregiver. And so what we try to do is meet the need of the patient with the appropriate peer visitor. So it may be meeting with a injury survivor with a survivor, or it may be the survivor with a caretaker. But what we're finding is the caretakers can identify from being here and being the ones that can't do anything but can only sit and watch, and the struggles and not know what questions to ask and so forth. So when our caregivers meeting with the patient's families can really help prep them to ask questions that they may not think of, or think of things long term that may be coming down the pike. Teaching them to write questions down daily as they come, and then really just helping them navigate through the system and letting them know that once the patient is discharged, you know, this resource is out here. These are the things that you might be seeing. These are the resources that you can tap into to help with that. Because there's frustration both within the survivor and with the caregiver, and to have a resource for both of them is our goal.
You mentioned the feedback you've gotten from the patients themselves. I wonder about the volunteers. What are you hearing from them? They've been through a horrible experience probably in the past. Do they see something positive coming out of it in that they can help someone else down the road?
That I probably don't have words for that. The smiles on their face that they know that they're making a difference with these patients. And it's humbling to see them wanting to come back onto the unit, especially some they hadn't come back to the unit. And their first visit back to start this program was really just remembering certain things about the experience and, you know, bringing a lot of that back. So they've been phenomenal. They are just beaming that they can make a difference.
Looking at the future of this project, do you see maybe someone who's a patient there this year? They might someday graduate and become one of these volunteers themselves.
Absolutely. So what we're hoping to do, because the recovery can be lengthy, and so when either a patient and or a caregiver feel they'd like to be part of the program, we're seeking volunteers right now, and what we'd like to do is get a group together and have another training within the next year, with the hopes of really broadening the group to not only then volunteer here in the hospital, but then start extending it out to the outpatient setting and into the community.
And Jody, before I let you go, 2 pieces of information. If someone in the area wanted to sign on as a volunteer, if they've been through this, how do they do that? And second, if somebody not in the Madison area is thinking, hey, we need this in our neck of the woods, how would they go about doing that?
Right. And so the program is the Brain Injury Peer Visitor Association. The main office is out of Alpharetta, Georgia. The director of that program is Ann Bariski. So the initial call will go to her at 770-330-8416. And there's also a website, which is abariski@braininjurypeervisitor.org. Either way can connect with her. Even if it's a patient in need and looking for a resource, she will triage the call and then connect with me and or a peer visitor in this area to connect a patient up. And she, if someone's interested in volunteering, she will do the initial screening, get the application going, and then we'll connect them back with me here at the hospital.
We'll put that phone number up on the Central Time Facebook page if anybody wants to check it out. Jody, thank you so much for sharing the story with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Jody Atwell, case manager for UW Hospital Neurosciences Intensive Care Unit, talking to us about a new brain injury peer visitor program at UW Hospital.